Are you a creative who just wrapped up your independent film, new book, or album release? Or are you just looking for help on your fundraising campaign? Well, then you're going to need a marketing strategy.
Smart House is a marketing agency that specializes in creative projects and independent films. They provide digital strategies, social media support, publicity services, branding, and fundraising strategies to help indie artists just like you.
Smart House was founded to help indie artists with all budgets find their audience and bring their projects to the world. Smart House has helped a ton of artists reach their goals, including the Making Movies is Hard podcast.
That's right. They're helping us grow our audience, and they can help you too. Go to smarthousecreative.com to get started today.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital DVD and Tubi, where people are watching it because I got someone like called me or emailed me after watching it on Tubi and said, check out my work. And I was very touched. So thank you, Terrence, for that.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer with made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and currently working on my next one. I'm a distribution consultant who does sales, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative.
This week, we welcome writer Saeed Crumpler on the show to talk about writing his first feature, Hip Hop Family Christmas, getting into his first writer's room, and how he got his overall deal with Sony, which we don't nearly talk about enough because it's incredible, but we do cover it, which is good too. After that, we play another round of The Game, and we read a listener email, and we read a new iTunes review. Someone took the top spot for 2023. What? Woo, 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 woo. But first, Liz, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm good. I feel like there's a lot I can't talk about, and that's all I can think about when you ask that question. Like, I just want to be like, well, this happened, this happened, but I can't talk about it. So I'm trying to think about bullshit to talk about instead. Got my blood pressure checked today. It was great. Good blood pressure. Very exciting moment for me. Watch a lot of Cake Squad when I'm bored. And we went to Super Nintendo World yesterday with my son. I'm not the audience to get excited about that, but we went because we thought Colin, my son, would like it. And we snuck onto the only ride, they weren't checking height really at the front of the line.
Oh,
so we jumped in the line, and then we got to the very end of the line, and we told him, we're like, Colin, don't go up on your tippy toes, but just, you know, lift up your feet a little bit when they measure you. Like, we were trying to teach him how to cheat, and he did. And it was so cute. Like, he really listened to us, and he really did cheat in a very thoughtful way. But he still didn't get on the ride, and it was very sad. But updates of my life.
Wow.
How are you?
Tell me more about Nintendo Land. Is that Disneyland? Is that the deal?
No, it's at Universal Studios. So.
Oh, wow.
I piled up all the rest of my days this week, and I took a day off yesterday to go to Universal. And, you know, I'm going to say, you walk in, very cool first image. And then after you really settle in, you're like, what is here? A cafe, a VR ride, and an opportunity to meet Princess Peach. It's not overwhelming, the options, but it looks cool. I think you would think it looks really cool.
So it's not like the Japanese Nintendo Land that's got the craziest rides and tubes that you can go through and all this stuff.
No.
Or whatever.
No, there's, yeah, you go through the pipes, but it's like there's two.
Oh,
of them.
That's cool.
Two big pipes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Two big pipes. Well, I was watching the Niners game and crying.
Oh, yeah. So sorry about that. By the way, unfortunately, I have to say this. Go Chiefs, I guess, is what I have to
go
say.
Go Chiefs.
Yeah, that's what Sean's rooting for, the Chiefs.
I can't decide who I want to root for because I'm mad at the Eagles.
Yeah, and be then mad
like,
at both.
But I'm like, but I'm like the Chiefs. I'm like, oh, well, they, you know, they screwed us up for a couple of years ago. But it's like, then they didn't make it to the Super Bowl last year. Mm-hmm. And Mahomes is such a good quarterback, and they're such a good team. It's like, dude, they deserve to win. They're so good. But then, like, I don't know. So I'm really torn who I want to root for. I just want to root for a good game. I want the game to be good.
That's worth rooting for. That's a good argument.
Yeah. And not crappy like the Niners game. But my point was, we watched the newest Mario Brothers teaser trailer. I came up on my phone while I was watching it with my daughter.
Yeah.
And she just was like, I want more of this. Whatever this is, I want more of it. And like, we went to a movie together for the first, I don't know if I told you this, but we went to a movie together a few weeks ago for the first time. It went okay. She made it for an hour in Puss in Boots, which I was like pretty impressed by. I was like,
we went to that
you did
one
it for an hour.
Wait, yeah, do you ply them with popcorn? Because that keeps my son there for the entire duration. Okay.
I did popcorn and then I gave a little bit of a lemonade. Although I regretted the lemonade decision afterwards.
Yeah, the lemonade. I gotcha.
All
I gotcha
she that. Wanted was lemonade. It was like, oh God, you can't drink this whole lemonade. It's this small, but it's still the biggest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Any kind of fruit juice, they turn into maniacs. I really learned that the hard way.
Yeah. But so we'd seen that the real trailer in the theater. That was like the first time she saw it in the theater. And she was like, her jaw dropped when she watched the Mario Brothers trailer in the theater. And so when she saw it on the phone, she just made me watch all the Mario Brothers trailers with her on the phone. And then she wanted to watch them again. And I was like, no, we're only doing them once. We're not doing them twice. So yeah, but I always want to train her. Like I'm trying to put her in like a training regiment. So like she'll be ready to sit through the Mario Brothers movie all the way through when it comes out in April. So we're going to try to go to another movie next weekend, see if she can get all the way through. And then if not, then we'll do another one. So I just like building her up so she can like actually be a good movie going buddy for me at like not even 2 years old. This is how excited I am to watch movies with my daughter.
I think Colin did that around that time. I'm trying to remember when we started going to movies. But I think I know what you're doing, but I always feel like a little weird that Colin takes to it so easily. I'm like, is my son a born zombie? Like, can he just like really immerse himself in media that easily? Like, I think it's actually good that she struggles with it a little bit. I think that's probably a good sign.
I feel like, so I have nephews who I love. They are wonderful boys, but they are 8 and 5 and they cannot watch a movie all the way through or barely. Their attention spans is just not what they're into. Like they want like quick and fast and blah. And you know, they just were never taken to movies when they were younger. Like I think the first movie either of them went to was like when they were like 5 or 4. I don't even Dominic hasn't he hasn't even been to a movie yet. He's 5. So like, you know, it's just like, okay. Well, that's why they don't like movies, because you didn't instruct them that movies are great, you know? And I feel like I was instructed that movies are great from when I was like 3 or 4, you know, being taken to Little Mermaid and whatnot. I feel like I want to do the same for my daughter, although I'm starting a little earlier with her, getting her on it now.
Yeah, no, I get it. I think that's the way to go. We got to instill an appreciation for the movie theater into the younger generation.
And I'm not saying I can like want to watch things all the time or anything. It's just like, you know, basically making it a special experience. Like we sit down and we watch it together. And then like I explain what's going on to her and we like talk through, you know, not in the movie theater, obviously, but like when we're at home watching a movie, just kind of make it like this like interactive like thing where it's like I'm doing it with her. Not that I'm saying anything wrong with letting them watch things on their phone by themselves, but I'm just, this is the way that we're doing it and it's fun. Anything movie related in my life, there's a meeting tomorrow that I'm supposed to be excited about, so we'll see what happens.
Yay!
I don't know what's going to happen at the end of this meeting, but it's like some in-person pitch to one of these old distributors. So, yeah, fingers crossed that goes well. Yeah, I don't know what else is new. I'm not writing. I should be writing. I've been thinking about it a lot, but yeah, haven't really been that a part of my new schedule yet. So hopefully this week I'll get some writing done.
Yeah, and if not, that's okay. If you don't get the writing done, we're all going to be okay.
But you know what's really, really great that everyone should do no matter what time it is in their life? I'm being attacked by my kitten right now. You should go to Patreon, www.patreon.com/MMIHpodcast and support the show. And a big, big happy birthday to James Kesselman and Rebecca Kesselman for supporting the show. James says, you all rock. We both listen to you a bunch and we want to watch your movies. Great job. So Rebecca and James, you are amazing. Thank you so much for the support.
And they made a movie called Next to North and it's wonderful. And I'm helping them out with sales. So we're going to make a big splash when it comes out. And so just pay attention to those names, James and Rebecca Kesselman, and the film Next to North.
Is there a trailer or something that we can see?
Not yet. James, my friend James, different James. My friend James Blythe is cutting the trailer, I think, right now.
Ooh, cool. Well, keep us posted on that, Liz. Yeah. And thanks again, Rebecca and James. You should also check out the International Screenwriters Association, the ISA. They're an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through a number of programs they offer, including consultation courses, contests, and of course their top 25 writers list featuring some of their very best writers. So head over to www.networkisa.org to sign up for free today. Without any more delay or blither blather, here is our chat with Saeed Crumpler. Saeed, welcome to the show, man. Thanks so much for being here.
Hell yeah. Happy to be here. Happy to be a part of it. I love podcasts. Podcasts used to be, especially film and screenwriting podcasts. Like, I used to listen to those when I was working a shitty job 9 to 5, and it would like keep me going. So I appreciate all the podcasts.
Awesome. Well, here, let's talk about Hip Hop Family Christmas. Can you give us the elevator pitch for the show? It's a show or a movie? Sorry.
It's a movie. So pretty much it follows hip hop's most famous family as they address negative press and soften their image in a live Christmas television special. And it revolves around his family in Texas that's like hip hop royalty. And they have, a son that wants to be an aspiring CEO of a record label. He has a daughter that's doing music. So it's really just like a hip hop family and them getting together for Christmas. And they're recording this live special. And a lot of their past comes out and they have to deal with it as a family at the end of the episode. I mean, at the end of the...
But the Christmas spirit prevails.
Christmas spirit always prevails.
Okay, there is, that's real important for me to know.
There is coffee and coats in the movie, which is something that has to happen. In Christmas movies, is like you gotta have some coffee, you gotta have some eggnog, and you gotta have like winter wear. Those are like
someone's gonna put a coat on.
Yeah, it has to be a coat.
Oh man,
how many days did you shoot?
What was funny, so I'll tell you what's interesting about this situation. So how this whole thing came about was Jamie Foxx company signed a deal with MTV to do a series of like first time diverse writers, diverse directors. And I think it was like a 4-movie deal. And a friend of mine named Adria Walden was in my writers group, which is crazy. I met her through the writers group and she was like, hey, you know hip hop. I know nothing about hip hop. She was like, I've been offered to rewrite this movie and finish this script called Hip Hop Family Christmas. And it's with Jamie Foxx's company. Are you down to meet? And I was like, yeah. She was like, send me your script. Send her the script. Because she had to send it to Jamie Foxx's people. Jamie Foxx's people was like, thumbs up. They had to send it to MTV. Thumbs up. At the time, I was in a Nickelodeon program for television writing, which was also owned by Paramount Plus, which owns MTV. So like one of my fears was like, oh shit, can I even write this movie when I'm in the Nickelodeon program? Because it was a 1-year program. And so it was all under Paramount. So it all ended up working out like some weird kismet. Mm. But what happened was that we had, when we came on, they were shooting in like 1 month and they were like, yo, we're still casting, but we need help with this script. So me and her came in and like rewrote the movie. And I think we turned the first draft in like 6 days. And then, and then we were on for notes twice. We got it done and they were shooting as we were like rewriting certain pages. It was like the Christmas movies happen fast. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, because they have to come out for Christmas, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, I think they were shooting in like September or August. And it was like, we have to shoot. So whether the script is done or not, we're shooting. So that's kind of how that situation came. I didn't get to make it to set because it was COVID.
Oh, yeah.
They had very strict like COVID things, protocols. And so we couldn't make it out there. But I got to see a lot of dailies and stuff like that. And it has like, it's funny because it has like some of my favorite rappers, like MC Lyte, who's like one of the first female rappers of all time. One of the greatest rappers, one of the coolest voices. Like, she does a lot of voice work. Redman was in it. It was like one of my favorite rappers. Neo, the singer, is in it. You know, Carrie Hilson is in it. Like, so it had a lot of talented artists in it. And so it was, you know, one of the few Black Christmas movies. And I think maybe one of the only ones that deal with hip hop in a sense. So it was good.
Nice. I mean, just to press on the original question, like, do you know how many days the movie shot? Was it like 20 days, 30 days?
It was probably like 2 weeks, I think. I think they shot that movie in like 2 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. Yeah. Like, it was like no play. And also, it's interesting because when you're writing specs on your own, money is not an issue. You see what I'm saying? So it's like, you're like, oh yeah, like there's this, you know, party and blah, blah, blah. And it was funny because it was like, yo, this party is too big. You know what I mean? Cause it was like, it's COVID protocol. Yeah. So there's like some of these scenes we had to change based off budget and COVID protocols, you know? So it was like, you know, which was interesting because it was like, damn, how do you shoot a party and make it look like it's crap? Like, you know what I mean? Like, so at first it was going to be at an event hall and then we put the party in a house, you know, which made for some some funny comedy scenes in the movie when the police come to Redman's house, which is a very funny scene. And but the police officer goes to church with Redman or something. So anyhow, it was like a 2 week shoot.
And then what was the rough budget, or do you know the rough budget?
That I don't know, but it definitely wasn't low budget. And that's the funny thing, is because I don't know the actual budget, but it was definitely millions. You know what I'm saying?
Mm, yeah.
And so that was cool. But I think the way they got around it was like, you know, shooting for 2 weeks. And it was interesting because most people's first movie are very low budget student films almost, or movies made with like what I call smudget budgets, where it's like, you know, you got $5,000, $10,000 trying to make a movie. So like, I get it. But no, for me, my first movie ended up being a made for television movie, which is ironic because Shonda Rhimes' first movie was a made for television movie called Crossroads with Britney Spears. That's a fun fact.
Oh, I remember that movie. I saw that movie. I worked in a video store at that time and I got it early. I know that this is kind of, well, whatever, you answer this question. How did you come up with the idea? We ask all of our writers and filmmakers how they come up with the idea, but it sounds like, can I ask something like, how much creative freedom did you have to depart from their idea or to come to the table with ideas?
A lot, you know, but there was a producer. So here's one thing, is like, one thing was cool was there was a producer named Datari Turner, who happened to be from the Bay Area also. I think he went to like El Cerrito High School or something. He was a producer on the film. So when we met up, he were like, these are certain things that we want. These are certain mandates that we want. We wanted to be in Texas. We wanted to have, and you know, I was a humongous fan of like Texas hip hop, like Bun B and UGK and Chamillionaire and stuff like that. So like, I already knew a lot of that stuff and I knew a lot of Texas slang. So I think when we came in, he was like, we really want to play up some of the Texasness. And you know, there was like a few things he wanted, like we want the son to like be trying to make it in the industry and start his own label, trying to get out his father's shadow. And so, but we had a lot of freedom in that, you know, as far as like, you know, I had experience running a record label. So like a lot of that storyline came from like me, you know, but yeah, we had pretty much control, but within guidelines, you know, where they're like, you need to hit these five markers. And so for you as a writer, it's like, how can we creatively do this? You know, like we want an argument between him and his girlfriend here. So how can we creatively do that? You know what I'm saying? There's going to be a conversation between him and his girlfriend. And like, how do you make that creative and different? So it had guidelines, but we had a lot of room to breathe.
Nice. And then the next question, basically, you already answered it. You said you worked on it for about like a month before you shot. But the last question I'll ask is, compared to all the other projects you've worked on, how difficult was this one?
This was actually a breeze, actually, because I was co-writing with a friend. So like, it's interesting because I was talking to a writer yesterday, and most of the, you know, like if you're writing features, you need to get used to co-writing, because you're either going to be co-writing with the director. Most of the times the director is going to co-write, like Matt Reeves' Batman. Like he was like very in the script for that movie. Christopher Nolan is somebody who's very in the script, you know, so it's like you should be familiar with collaboration, but sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. You know what I'm saying? And it was interesting because Adrian and I, we had never wrote together before, but we were friends already from the writers group that we are a part of. And it was pretty easy. It was like, you know, we had the outline. It would be like, these are scenes I want to write. These are scenes she wants to write. We went to write them, put them together. And then it'd be like, all right, you take a pass. And she take a pass. Then I take a pass. And we're not precious with any of these passes. You know, anything could be changed. But then once we start taking a couple passes, that's when it's more or less like, before we change shit, let's like talk to each other. Like, it's like, hey, I might want to change this or I might want to change that. But I think we were very open and not, you know, acting like it's more like clay instead of cement. And I think sometimes collaborations go wrong when two people aren't seeing eye to eye, or, you know, somebody doesn't like to be rewritten. And for me, it was like, look, we're going to rewrite each other. Like that was something we said in the beginning, like, hey, rewrite my shit. I'm going to rewrite your shit. This is going to end up like something in between us both. And then from there, we'll finalize it and rewrite. Because I think it's better that way. Because like, to me, it's like, what's the point of collab? I was telling somebody else this yesterday. It's like, what's the point of collaborating if you were going to create something that you would have created alone anyway? Yeah. You know, it's like, yeah, that's just laziness. Like, like, it's too hard to finish this script, so I need somebody to help me. But thinking true collaboration is when two people get together to make something they couldn't have made on their own.
There are way better questions for me to ask, but I will be distracted the entire time if I don't ask this. What kind of other mandates were you required to put into the script because it was a Christmas movie? Like the coats and coffee one blew my mind. So, and I know that there's certain like big city girl comes to small town. Was there anything else along those lines you were told?
Yeah, you definitely have to have like coffee and snuggle coat scenes. You definitely got to have, I think we had like a gingerbread house building scene. Which was funny because here's the flip we did on it, though. Like for us, it was like, hey, you got these five characters. They're all trying to make gingerbread houses, but each one with their personality is going to make a different kind of gingerbread house. Some are going to be fucked up. Some are going to be like crazy. Some are going to be falling apart. And that's an extension of character. So that was like one of the things we did where it was like, OK, well, look, we're going to have this gingerbread Christmas moment. But how do we make this serve story? Right. And I think that was one that's the little way as a writer where you could be like, OK, well, we have to have, or you got to have the kiss. Right.
Mistletoe. Right.
Like, yeah. So how do we do this in a way that satisfies us as a writer also? Because I wasn't a fan of Christmas movies, to tell you the truth. Like,
what?
I'm just going to tell you the truth. Like, I'm not. But she was. And like, that's the reason why I think the movie came out the way it did, is because she's a fan of it. I'm not. And I was more interested in the hip hop part of it. And so we like balanced each other out, and it would always be like, ah, that's a little too corny for me. And then and then likewise, it would be like, all right, well, we got to dial this back. This is a Christmas movie. So yeah, that was like one of the mandates. I'm trying to think what other Christmas, you know, obviously you got to have singing performances. Like that was another thing. Like, you know, we had to have, I think it was like, we had to have three performances. Also, you have artists in a movie, right? So it's like, you got to write a scene where Neo can sing, you know, or otherwise, why is he in there? You got to write a scene where like MC Light is rapping, like, or why is she, you know what I mean? So that was the cool part where it was like, I think one of the coolest things was like writing the scenes where the performance would be and then seeing the final product and being like, oh, this turned out like, you know what I mean? Like, oh, this is actually a cool song. Like there's a scene where Redman and MC Light are performing together. And I'm like, damn, this is like a good song. And I think in production, they went on their own and like made a song together. And so those were the things that were surprises to me. Because, you know, when you're writing a script, you're like, they do a dope hip hop song. Like, you know what I'm saying? Then you're like,
insert
you're like,
performance here. Yeah.
and you like got your fingers crossed that, you know what I'm saying? It's MC Light and Redman who are like hip hop legends. So like, yeah, shit turned out hot. So that was one of the surprises. But those were some of the mandates they had.
So I think we're missing a big part of context on you as a writer, because you have a really fantastic story. I got to talk to you a little bit at the Austin Film Festival. So can you just tell us like how you got into writing and sort of like some of the circumstances that led you to be in the position to write your first feature film for money?
Yeah, for money. Yeah, no, I know. It's like that's probably I spent a whole bunch of years not making money. But I will say I came from a hip hop background, but I went to San Francisco State University, which at the time was a good. There we go. It was a good school.
SF State.
Yep. Was a good school for cinema at the time. Took a screenwriting class. It was like a black screenwriting teacher named Larry Clark. And I remember he was like, you have a voice. And I was like, what the fuck is a voice? And later on in college, I was still doing rap music, graduated, dove headfirst into rap music because the Bay Area is like a humongous independent rap scene. I did that for about 15 years, as well as working at a local record store called Rasputin's.
Shout out Rasputin's.
Shout out Rasputin's on Telegraph. I worked there so many years. And maybe about 6 years ago, I felt like I needed a change, you know, in my life. I was getting ready to turn 40, you know what I'm saying? Like I was getting in the late 30s and I was like, fuck, what? I can't keep doing the same shit I'm doing. And so I took a online television writing class at UCLA. So what happens, I entered UCLA, got rejected, grad school, entered NYU, got rejected. But UCLA emailed me. No, and LMU put me on the waiting list. Shout out LMU for putting me on the waiting list. But UCLA emailed me and they were like, hey, you know, we're not letting you into the grad school, so don't get excited. But we have this online writing class that you could be a part of if you pay $5,000. And at that time, man, I did not have $5,000. And then my, you know, sad story, my grandmother passed and she left me like, I think it was $10,000. And so I took half of that money, invested in this UCLA online class. I remember the day the money got taken out of my account, I was crying. Like, I was like, Jesus, y'all taking it all out at once? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it ain't even in installments. Jesus Christ. And I was working at Rasputin's, and at night I would take these UCLA writing classes for television. And it was the first time I was taught by like real television writers. And I came, and it was on Skype. This is like before Zoom. I used to tell people at my job, like, I'm in this class. It was called television. I think it was called Professional Television Writing Course or something at UCLA. And I used to be like, I'm in this class. And like, how are you doing that? You're crazy. I'm like, there's a screen and there's a teacher and the students who raise our hand. Like, the whole idea of what Zoom, like, it was just crazy. Nobody could put their head around it. And so I came out of there with an Atlanta spec, a pilot, and another pilot. And I queried and got a manager, and then wrote a query letter, got a manager. Once I got a manager, I entered every contest, lost everything for like 2 years. And didn't get discouraged, still entered shit. And then I got to the finals of Warner Brothers Fellowship, didn't get in. Then I made it in a Nickelodeon in January. And that's what kind of started everything. This is last year. And through all of that and just meeting different writers and stuff, work started happening. And my first writing assignment that I got paid for was because of my UCLA teacher named Kelly. She knew a producer that wanted to write a movie on Bay Area rapper Mac Dre. And she was like, Saeed would be perfect for this. And they ended up paying me to write that script, which was the first time I got paid. So I got paid relatively fast.
That's amazing. I'm also thinking about many people who hit that stage of like mid-career level, right? You're like 40s around the corner. And I know that you wrote music, but writing scripts is a different kind of process. So how did you generate a habit like of writing regularly? Did it come out of the blue, or did it come from your foundation of writing music?
I think the foundation of writing music helped. Writing music is hard because you have to like entertain somebody for 3 minutes, and you have to tell a story beginning, middle, to end, and you have like a hook and all that type of stuff. So like it kind of helped season me for that. Also, the idea of being independent, where like you have to spend your own money on your shit. There's no record label to save you. So it was kind of like, you know, being in the Bay Area, there's no Def Jam Records or Capitol Records anywhere around. So it was like the entrepreneur spirit, like when it came time for me to like pay for contests or pay for coverage and shit like that, I was like, oh shit, this is how it is. Like, this is just the entry fee for trying to get in the game. So it didn't discourage me. I was just like, all right, I'm going to work my shitty job and I'm going to save, you know, a certain amount of money every period so that I can enter these contests and get this coverage to make my script better. So that helped, but it did reach a point. And it's funny because I tell people this, it reached a point though, where I had to sacrifice making money, where I was working so much just to have healthcare and I couldn't write. And so I damn near went without healthcare for like 6 months just so I could. And I was like, I'm not going anywhere. I'm not going down the street, like, because I cannot afford to get hurt. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I can't drive a vehicle. Like, and what I did is I think I took 2 days off at work so I could write. One on Wednesday so I could have the middle of the week, and then one on Saturday. I was like, those days I religiously went to a Starbucks or Peace Coffee in the Bay Area, and I used to go around the different ones so I wouldn't get bored. And I did that for about a year or two right before COVID happened. And I think that set me up to where it put me in the mode of writing every day, or working on multiple things. And being in that class forced me to write. Like, I think one of the hardest things is like discipline, but sometimes you might just want to take a class so that'll force you to write that script, you know?
Yeah. Wow. So I want to hear a little bit about getting your manager and like how you queried. Like, what was your process? How many emails did you send? How long did that take? And then once you got the manager, it sounds like that wasn't it. Like, that's when the work began. So just also want to hear a little bit about like what it was like having a manager and how that changed your process, or if it changed your process.
Yeah, it's funny because it did and it didn't. Like I kind of equate having a manager to in the industry to like having a license to drive. So it's like you need a license to drive. You can drive without a license. I wouldn't suggest it, but just having a license doesn't make you a good rider, or it doesn't make you a good driver. You know what I'm saying? And it doesn't mean you're going to get there faster, but it's just you need it to drive. Right. And so because a lot of these companies don't take unsolicited material, so you do need a manager. And I look at it as just like having a license. But for me, what happened was like also coming from music, I knew the importance of having a manager. And so immediately getting out of like, it's funny because I always tell people, I like, you know, once you start getting in contests and shit, you need to try to get a manager as fast as possible because you got to start making inroads into the industry. And so as soon as I got out of school, I was like, I need a fucking manager. So I researched how to get a manager. Like I looked on YouTube and I looked at manager interviews, literary agent, literary manager interviews. And like, I just started taking notes and just realizing what they wanted, what they didn't want. And then I wrote a query letter. I got on IMDb Pro for the trial period. and I looked up, what I did is like, I went to IMDb. I looked up every television show I liked, right? And I felt like I could write on. And I looked up every writer, and I think 50% of them had their manager's email. And I just started collecting those emails. And then once I got the query letter down, I started blasting that query letter to the managers. I probably sent 5 emails a week for like 10 weeks. So I probably hit up like 50 managers. I ended up hearing back from like 10, right? That request a script. And then after sending the script, you know, half of them said pass. The other half was like, oh, I'm interested. Like send me something else. Then I sent something else and then it came down to like 4. And I ended up signing with my manager that I've had for 3 years. He was a junior manager at the time. Now he's a manager with Bellevue. One of the things that people do wrong in their query is they make it too fucking long. They don't get to the point and they list more than one project. Like so many times I run into somebody, they'll be like, I have all these projects. Do I put all the projects? No, like you need to put one log line. That log line needs to be super strong. And you're really sending like a paragraph. I wrote a whole article about writing a query letter that you can find. If you Google my name, Saeed Crumpler, and query letter, you'll find it. And it like details what the query letter should have, which is pretty dope. Cause some like writers have came up to me and said, you know, funny at Austin, one of my writer buddies bought me dinner. Cause he was like, I got a manager from your query letter article. Yep.
Wow. That's awesome.
I have a question that I ask everyone, I guess now about confidence, because it confuses me. And so I'm just like, people having confidence confuses me. And I guess, how do you derive the conviction of advocating for yourself in this way? I think that's unusual. I think it's wonderful. How did you build that?
It's funny because I think I just figured at some point something is going to happen. Like either, because one thing I learned from music was like, you're going to spend a certain amount of time not that good. And then if you keep working on it every day and you're getting constructive feedback, you're going to get better. And so there's a book called Atomic Habits by James Clear, which was a book I read at the same time that I was kind of like going through this and writing on a day-to-day basis. And it talks about how if you work on something, if you develop the habit and you do it daily, incrementally, you'll get better every year by like some crazy percentage. Mm-hmm. And so I just figured either I'm going to get better each year by like 50% each year, which started to happen. And I'm going to just keep doing it. Like I looked at the no as like, it's funny because now I look at no or a pass is just like not right now, you know, instead of a no. And it's funny because I have friends who are like entering shit and they're losing right now. And I'm like, you're me 2 years ago. I was like, if you're losing right now, you're probably closer than you think you are. Like if you know, like if you're running through second guessing yourself and all that type of stuff, and it's hard, you know, because writing is a lonely thing and people don't really understand it and you're getting no a lot. I was like, but you're actually closer than you think, because I entered Nickelodeon twice. I entered CBS 4 times. I entered HBO twice. I entered Disney 3 times. Like I just kept entering. And to me, it's just like, just keep entering. Like, what else are you going to do? You know, like don't stop. Just keep entering. hiring and keep getting better. And also write more shit, because I think sometimes people work on the same script for like 5 years. And it's like, that's cool, but you need to be working on other shit at the same time. So I feel like you get better with each script, you know, you should be.
So I want to hear about your overall deal with Sony. Cause like, I haven't really met anybody who's had an overall deal before. I don't really know what an overall deal means or what it is. So I'd love to hear, like, kind of explain what it is and then how it came to be and what you're doing with that.
So an overall deal is, it's like playing for the Yankees, where it's like you're signed to the Yankees. You can't play on any other team and you must play ball for that team, which is a great opportunity. But pretty much, so what it is I signed with Sony. It's a development deal, which means I create television shows exclusively for Sony, as well as I exclusively work on Sony television shows, which means Sony is going to staff me on their television shows. And I work on projects either Sony brings me to develop as a television show, or my own television shows I create and develop through Sony. How it happened is like a weird thing where, like I say, if you're an upcoming writer, enter every fucking thing possible. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, because sometimes as a writer, you get to a point, like I have friends who like place in a lot of contests, and then they get like this kind of like elitism where it's like, all right, I'm not, man, I'm just going to wait. Like, I'm not going to enter, like, why would I enter in this? I already placed in nickel, I already placed in that. But I used to enter everything. And so there was this program on Twitter, it's called Hollywood Here, where executives wanted to meet diverse writers. And this is like during 2020 in the beginning of COVID. And so it was like a weird tweet. And I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't know who these people are. This isn't like a, I did it anyway. I entered a script. I filled out the info. And then they had a thing where people from Sony TV were meeting you for a 10 minute. I mean, it's super quick, 10 minute Zoom. And so one of the people I met with two people from Sony. One was a development guy named Brett King. He was super cool, hella funny. Me and him talked about, like, he used to hang out with Russell Simmons and Rick Rubin in New York during Def Jam. So he was telling me all these crazy ass stories. And then I ended up meeting the woman who ended up giving me my development deal, which is Lauren Stein, and at Sony. And both of them were like 10 minute interviews. You know, you show up, they may or may not have read your script, but you tell them about your story, blah, 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 what you're doing, what you like to write, listen to them a little bit, and get out. But what happened is each of them were like, I like you, take my email, keep in contact. And this is something that a lot of writers do wrong, is they don't really keep in contact, or they're scared to keep in contact, or like, what do I do? How do I? And so I would enter contests just so I could keep in contact with people. So it'd be like, hey, I just placed in Script Pipeline, you know? Oh, that's dope. Keep going. Hey, I just placed in a Final Draft. Oh, that's dope. Keep going. Right. Then it's like, happy Thanksgiving. Thank you. Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. Right. Then it was like, hey, I made it in a Nickelodeon. Oh, that's dope. Keep going. Right. Then it would be like, I'm writing a Christmas movie for MTV. Dope. Keep going. Then it would be like, I got staffed on a Showtime show called Flatbush Misdemeanors. Oh, that's dope. Keep going. And then at the beginning of this year, she emailed me and she was like, hey, I was just talking about you, which is something that happens in this industry a lot more than people think. Even when you don't know or you're not hearing about it, if you have good work and you're like a good person, people will like start talking about you. And so she was like, I was just talking about you. Can you send me your comedy script? I had it. Bam. 30 minutes later in her inbox. A week later, she was like, do you have a drama script? 30 minutes later in her box. Like, you know what I'm saying? None of this like, give me 3 weeks. I got to do like another polish. Like, you know what I'm saying? Which happens. So like as a writer, you need to be prepared. So I was prepared for that. And then she reached back out to me and she was like, these scripts are amazing. I want to sign you to a development deal. And I was like, what? And so here we are today, 4 months in, and I'm just pitching television shows and working on television shows and signed to Sony TV now.
And they pay you a yearly salary?
Yes.
Damn.
Yep. Also, side note, Nickelodeon paid me weekly. So like one of the funny things, like a lot of people, like sometimes you run into people and they'll be like, I'm not going to enter Nickelodeon writing program. But Nickelodeon writing program is one of the few programs that pay you weekly. So I didn't have to work. I quit my job. And at the time, I think I was doing an online job because Rasputin's was closed because of COVID. But I was like working online for Music Monitor Network. And I was preparing to work another year for Music Monitor Network on Zoom. And I got in Nickelodeon in January. Nickelodeon ended up getting me on Showtime. So if it wasn't for Nickelodeon, that I probably wouldn't be where I am today. So that's the funny thing. Like I tell a lot of writers where it's like, you really have to think about this shit like chess, and you're never too big or too good to enter or send your shit anywhere. Enter everything, because you never know, one little thing could turn into something else, could turn into something else. So I feel like I'm definitely an example of like entering everything, working hard to get better all the time. And then just one thing led to another thing, led to another thing.
And it started with music, right? And then you came to film mid-career. Are you able to do both now, or are you focusing full time on TV and film, or where is music now?
It's hard to do both, I'm not going to lie. So like I definitely put music on the back burner the past 4 years when I was really trying to get better. And like, because it is hard to do both at a high level. But I do see a world in the future, like I would like to do the music for my movies and the music for my television shows, kind of like how Donald Glover does. I don't want to be an artist, you know, per se. I don't want to like go do shows and all that type of shit. I'm done with the performing at clubs and risking your life for $1,500. But I definitely see a world where like I make my own music. It's funny because I just recently released my Atlanta spec, and I made a song that goes along with the Atlanta spec that is written from the perspective of Paperboy. So it's like I wrote a song for Paperboy that goes along with the script. The script is called Spider Chicken. Those are the type of things I want to do, where it's like, you know, like if I do make a show, I'm definitely going to do a song probably for the show.
Amazing. Talk a little bit about getting into your first writer's room and what that experience was like, and like how you navigated the room, and like kind of some big lessons you took away from being in that room.
What's crazy is the first room I was in was shadowing a Nickelodeon show called Blaze and the Monster Machines. It's like a pre.
Oh, I know Blaze and the Monster Machines. Yes, of course I know Blaze and the Monster. We're big fans of that show in our house.
What's funny is I love that show. I love the creators, Jeff and Alan. I learned so much from being in that room that had me prepared for when it became time for being in the Showtime room. Just seeing how they think about shows, breaking story. Also, it was a very, like, they were the coolest because, like, they would ask me what I thought. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, they'll be like, Saeed, what do you think? And or Saeed, you got an idea? And so it kind of taught me like the process of like when to talk, when not to talk, when to pitch ideas, when not to, which is probably the hardest thing when you're in the room the first time. And what's funny is I ended up writing a freelance episode for Blaze that is actually going to be on next year's show. So they actually made it. I got to see the animatics. Super cool. But after Blaze, I worked on Blindspotting on Stars for 2 weeks as a consultant, because I grew up with Rafael Casal and David. That was amazing too, because I got to work on that show. So like going from Blaze as a shadowing to being a consultant. And then when I got on Showtime, I was like more than ready. And one of the things was like just knowing when to talk, you know, never talk over the showrunner, never shit on an idea, right? Always yes and, you know, kind of like when you're in improv, it's like always and one. Never know. It was super, 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 super fun because I was in a room filled with comedians. Like, I think Kevin and Dan are stand-ups. Carrie is stand-up. Drew, who was another writer in there, was stand-up. Fran worked on Insecure. Nika, she was new. I was new. Adam was new. So it was like, it was probably like a 6 or 7 people writer's room. Amazing experience. You also realize like the only way to make shows go is with multiple minds. And so it's like the hive mind wins every time. Like, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, because it's like, you know, when you work on your own pilots, it's like, man, it'll take you like a year to write a pilot. And like another year to rewrite and punch up jokes. And it's like, could you imagine trying to write a show all by yourself? Like, Jesus, the amount of time. But being in a room, it was cool because you got eight different minds, eight different perspectives, eight different experiences, all pitching in story for these characters. And so it was just, it's really like a running train. It's like when it goes, it's going. And so some of the things I used to do to prepare myself was like, I watched the whole seasons and I like took notes of like what each character said. And I learned that from writing specs. Because I wrote an Insecure in Atlanta. And so when you write a spec, you know, you got to research, like, what are the words they say? How do they talk and stuff like that? So like one of the first things, like I wrote down, all right, Dan says this, Kevin says this. And I used to watch, I'm not from New York, I'm from the Bay Area. And so I used to watch YouTube videos of people in Brooklyn talking just so I get the slang down, right? And the words. I ended up getting an episode on that show. I wrote episode 209 along with Dan, and it was a great experience. I love being in the writer's room. And then also when you're in the room, you start learning the proper way to pitch something. Like one of the keys is like always pitch from personal experience or stories. You know, if you have an idea, it's better to say, hey, one time this thing happened to me where I went into this coffee shop and, you know, like this guy bumped into me and it, like, you know what I'm saying? It's better to pitch it from personal experience to just say, oh, what if a guy bumped into him at the coffee shop? Like, you know what I'm saying? And so you start learning like how to pitch stuff and the slang in the room. Like I noticed like Dan would always say, what if there's a world where this and this and And so I would start saying, what if there's a world where, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, you pick up the lingo of the room. So the writer's room was a great experience.
Arik, I think it's time to move to our final six, unless you have last one.
One more.
Go
one
for
more.
It.
Let's go.
So you got your overall deal. You've had all this experience. You've been in writer's rooms. You've written a feature. Are you like one pitch away from like creating and like running your own show? Or do you feel like that you have a little bit more work in order to like get that kind of trust to go to that level?
I think I'm one pitch away from running a show. I think one of the cool things now is that they're looking, I think the industry is fiending for new blood and new voices and new ideas. So it's not like it used to be where you had to be staffed for like 6 years before you get to sell a show. That comes with pluses and minuses though, because, you know, I've only been in one real room. I've shadowed a couple rooms and I was a consultant, but I definitely want to get in another room before I run a room just so I could just see. Cause when you're in the room, you start picking up like, ooh, that's how I want to run my room. Right. But yeah, I'm like literally one pitch away. I mean, hopefully one of these shows that I'm working on ends up getting sold when we come back. But yeah, I'm like one pitch away.
Wow. That's amazing.
Thanks, bro.
Well, let's look back. Let's go back in time. So let's first go. Question, what's the first script you ever wrote and how do you feel about it now?
First script I wrote is trash, but it was a personal story. A friend of mine, when we were in high school, he robbed banks. But the way he did it was he would get in your car and he would say, hey, can you take me to the bank? And he would get out, go rob the place, and then come back in your car, right?
No advance warning for you, the driver. No advance warning.
And I think my first script was called 11. No, it was called 12. It was called 12. And I think he died at 12 o'clock or something. Like, it was so on the point. But that was the first script I wrote in class at San Francisco State. And that was the one where my teacher said, you have a voice. But, oh, that script is trash. Yeah, script is trash.
What's the best filmmaking advice or writing advice you've ever received?
A couple. One of them is don't write what you think they want. Write what you want to see. So that's something I always write what me and my friends want to see. I don't write what I think is hot in the industry, or I don't do that type of shit, because that's always going to change and you're always going to be behind. And that's one thing I learned about music. It's like, make the music that you and your friends want to hear. You'll be all right. So I do think upcoming writers spend too much time trying to write something to get on that they don't really like, but they think other people are like. Just write what you want to see and let it come around to you. The other thing is, I think William Goldman said, nobody in Hollywood knows anything. Like, and so to me, that's probably the realest shit, which is like, look, everybody's trying to figure this shit out. You know what I mean? Somebody will tell you, oh, period pieces don't sell. We're not looking for period pieces. And then a fucking Crown comes out and sells hella shit, and then they're still telling you don't make period pieces, and you're like, even though the Crown exists, and they're like, yep. And then, you know, so just write what you want, just hold on to it, you know what I'm saying? And then the last one is, writing is rewriting, which is the realest shit of all time. Where it's like, you know, if you, I have a saying where it's like, if you know how many drafts of your script you're on, you ain't had enough drafts. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, I can't even, like, the script that I have, like, both of those scripts that I sent to Sony, I can't even tell you the draft number. Like, I'd have to go and look at final draft. Like, it's definitely not 10. Definitely not 15. It's probably not 20. It's probably over 20 rewrites of this shit. So those are my three ones.
Do you have any bad advice that you've received or you've heard?
Yeah. Don't write query letters. Managers don't read them.
I can't tell you. I heard like that so many times through Austin, and I heard the exact opposite equal amount of times at Austin. So no, it's so funny how there's like a split on this, but like, it clearly works. I met enough people to prove that it works.
And it's still working. You know, a friend of mine just did it and she got reached back out by two managers. So it still works.
Do you have a goal as a writer?
Yes. I think like, so, well, let me say this. Like, I want to be Phoebe Waller-Bridge. I want to be Donald Glover. I want to be Shonda Rhimes. I want to be Kenya Burris. Those are the people I want to be. Goal wise, I just want to push. Then the other goal is I just want to make it cool for other writers that look like me who think they can't do it to want to do it, because they'll be like, oh shit, he did it, you know? And so that's like the personal goal.
Were you about to shout out a show? You were saying watch something and then I didn't know what it was.
Oh no, but I was, oh no, was I gonna shout out a show? No, but like watch Fleabag.
Oh, okay, there we go. If you could go back in time, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
Be patient and follow your gut and you'll be okay. Those are like the three. Yeah, because it's a lonely road. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think I talked about this on a panel at Austin Film Festival. It was like, I think my family thought I was depressed for a couple of years, because it was just like you be in your room writing or whatever, or, you know, like your friends, you're not hanging out with your friends. Your friends are like, man, like you have turned into a fucking hermit. And it's like, you know, you have to sacrifice in order to make shit happen. You know, like I can't just go out as much as everybody else. One, because I'm spending money on contests instead of eating with y'all. You know what I'm saying? Or going out. But yeah, it takes a lot of, you know, it's a lonely road, but it pays off though.
And last question, is writing television and movies hard?
Fuck yes. Yes. I mean, to write it well, yes. And then you realize a lot of the stuff is out of your control. I mean, as far as like, you know, you look at some of the best shows. Some of the best shows have the best cast, right? So you look at Succession, it's like amazingly cast. You look at Fleabag, amazingly cast. You look at Atlanta, amazingly cast. Breaking Bad, amazingly cast. And all these shows, multiple stars come out of, right? Sopranos. And so one thing I've been thinking about a lot lately is, yes, it definitely has to be a great script. But at the same time, you need a great director, you need a great production team, and you need a great cast and actors to like embody these things and to make the words even better. It's funny because I think there's a YouTube video. One of my favorite movies is Heat with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. And so there's a version of that movie that was made for television with different actors. And if you go on YouTube, you could look it up. And it's like some of the same dialogue being said by not Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. And you see the complete difference, bro. It's like, oh, wow. And so you start to realize, even when you're doing television, you start to realize like, oh, this is really just a blueprint. And the actors, it's really magic when the actors take it and turn it into real human beings and real dialogue. So.
Wow, amazing.
What would you like our listeners to do? What's your call to action? Do you want them to follow you, to follow their dreams, to give to charity? What do you want them to do?
Funny, because when I get back to the Bay, I got like five boxes I'm going to give to the Goodwill. So I definitely feel like you need to give to charity for sure. you know, because life is hard out here. And I believe in karma. So keep the karma wheel going. But what I will say is, like, if you're at a shitty job and you're writing and like you're losing contests and shit, which I was doing all of these things, I would say keep going, write the next thing, get feedback by friends and stuff. Keep entering over and over. If you really want to do it, the shit will, I think it, like, it's funny because like the only people who aren't successful are the ones who quit. I really believe that, because there were writers in my UCLA class that were better than me. One was a woman. She was fire. And there was another, there was an Asian writer. He was fire. And I'm trying to get him back in it, but he had quit. Like, he had stopped and got a regular job. And the woman writer, like, she stopped. And I'm like, damn. And it really is like, you just stop. And when you stop, there's no shot of you getting in. But I think if you keep going and keep working, you can get in. So my advice is just, hey, keep working, keep writing, give feedback. If you see the same note three times, change that shit.
Amazing.
Thank you for being on the show.
Hell yeah. Thank you for having me.
Do you love Making Movies as Hard and you want to listen to more episodes?
Jump over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/MMIH and you can listen to the entire back catalog of episodes for just $1.99 a month.
That's an additional 300 episodes that aren't on iTunes that you can listen to whenever you please.
But without any more blibber blabber, back to the show. Liz, what do you remember about our chat with Saeed?
I just remember liking him. I remember that he's from the Bay Area. And I don't know if you feel this way, but there always feels like when you talk to someone from the Bay Area as someone who's a Bay Area native, you're just kind of like, oh, there's kind of like a more laid back attitude to the people that I meet from the Bay. And I felt like very, I'm not a laid back person, but I am attracted to laid back people. And so I was attracted to like his calmness, his coolness. And I also loved that he gave us all the dirt on the quotas of holiday movies, like what's required in the script of a holiday movie. Yeah. So I just remember it being like just a really lovely conversation. What do you remember?
Well, so I met Saeed at a party at Austin Film Festival, which was, you know, really, really fun. He basically told me like, not his whole story, but like a whole bunch of it, like at this party, because I just kept asking him questions. And yeah, it was pretty much that conversation, but like lengthened. And I was really excited because we like covered everything and more that we covered when we met, you know, in the podcast. So I thought that was really good. I remember him, his dedication to writing and his, the way he covered, came up with a schedule and a plan to get his writing done before he, like, you know,
right,
started getting paid to write. Like, you know, he had a day job at Rasputin Music, which I used to go to all the time. Mm-hmm. I probably saw him many times because he worked there all the years that I was going there. Yeah. He said he went down from like 5 days to 3 days, tightened his belt. And then just those other 2 days he spent writing. He would just go to a Starbucks or some coffee shop and just spend the whole day writing 2 days a week. And then that was like kind of how he got all his samples and stuff going. I just thought that was like incredible advice, you know, just like create the space for yourself to write and just do it. And like, if you're not super productive that day or whatever, or you're not writing, at least you're there putting the time in to write. And it's like, that will get your muscle going. And I thought that was just really, really valuable.
100% was one of my favorite chats. Thanks, Saeed. But Alric, I have something for you. I have a question for
the game.
Do you want to do it? Do you want to replace that? Would you like
the game?
There we go. Thank
yours
you.
Was good, though.
Yeah, it was good. Okay. So Eric Toms, our producer extraordinaire, sends us a question every week for one of us to answer blindly. They are indie film quandaries, quagmires. You know, every week I use the phrase quandary and quagmire, and I haven't really looked it up to see if those are similar. Like, are there similar definitions? Have I just decided they're the same word? I don't know. He sets up an indie film problem for us to use our indie film brains to try to solve. And so this week, here's his prompt. You are a few weeks away from your next film, and although it's a small budget with a relatively unknown actor or relatively unknown actors, you really feel that this could be a critical success. However, in order to pull that off, you'll need all of your department heads on the same page. Unfortunately, the production designer is clashing with the DP because the two feel that the overall look of the film should be two completely different things. To make matters worse, the screenwriter sides with the production designer and the producer sides with the DP.
Ugh.
You'll be the deciding vote, but if you choose either side, then there will be bad feelings going forward. Do you? A. Fire the whole team and start over.
Oh, wow.
B, okay. B, put your foot down, side with one team, and let everyone know that if they don't like the decision, then they could leave the project. C, compromise both visions, trying to sandwich them into one idea and hope for the best. D, other. What do you do, director? What do you do?
Oh, man, I love this question. This is great. I love it so much. I mean, it wasn't terrible or anything, and it wasn't so, like, down to the root of, like, the look of the movie or whatever, but I did have DP production designer clashes on my movie over many different things, you know? And so I've been there, right? But, like, it wasn't like this. It wasn't like it was before we shot and... You know, like one person wanted one thing and the other person wanted the other thing and they couldn't decide or whatever. It's like they, you know, it kind of, we all kind of had the shared vision and then we just sort of plunged in. And then there are like, you know, a variety of like, you know, things throughout that came up. But, oh man, I think this is really hard because I think you work really hard to make sure that like you're all on board with the shared vision, that like you have a vision that the production designer shares, the DP shares, the producer shares, everyone shares, and they can all have slightly different versions of said vision. But right. As long as they're not in conflict, it's okay. But the fact that this is, they're in conflict, this is crazy. So I'm just trying to think about like how you basically have to work really hard to make sure this doesn't happen.
Right.
But if it does happen, what do you do? I don't know. I definitely can't fire everybody. Because if you want to actually make the movie, like, you can't just fire the whole team. Like, you'll never, it'll take years to make it again, right? Like, you really got to get, especially on an indie movie with, like, no cast and everything, and there's obviously no money. It's like, you have to, like, people will have to will the movie into existence with you. Like, you know, people aren't doing it for the money. It's, like, a big time commitment. People have families, lives, children, all these things. Like, to get someone to go in with you, it's a big deal. You know, it's like you can't just replace somebody. And then you also have to be creatively aligned with everybody, which is like also another hard thing. So the other option was fire one, side with one, fire the others. And then the other one was compromise.
Well,
and another
put your other. Like side with one and let people know if they don't like the decision, they can leave. And then C is compromise both visions, trying to sandwich them into one idea.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I guess it so comes down to like the specifics of what the vision is. But I think like for me, like I would always try to find the compromise, you know? So if it doesn't alter my vision, right? If their dispute is something that's like superficial or, you know, like cosmetic, let's say, and doesn't actually change the story, then I would probably just try to come up with like some sort of compromise between the two that everyone's happy with, right? Like some sort of solution that I like, and the DP likes, and you know, the production designer likes. Just like try to find that middle ground, you know? And then if the middle ground doesn't exist and like somebody is like not playing ball, then you have to think about replacing them. Because if they're not willing to work in the collaborative medium that is film that we've all agreed to work in, and they're like, I will not do this. Then it's like, well, maybe you caught a bad seed before you got into production, you know? But yeah, I don't think you can't fire everybody. And I wouldn't want to put my foot down and pick one because unless like I disagreed with one of them, I guess it depends on where I was that part of it? Did they say what I thought about any of this?
No. And that's like my major issue with the question, right? Is like as director, you are supposed to communicate the vision and it sounds like you're getting two different interpretations of what you're putting forth. Like, I don't understand how the production designer could clash with the DP in a crucial way. I can get like minor things where the DP wants production designer to move a dresser a little bit to the left and the production designer's like, no, that's not where it should, you know, it's like, I get that. But how can you have a major conflict over the look of the film when like the overall look of the film is probably being encouraged by the director? Is there a breakdown of communication?
Well, they could also have like different ideas for color palettes, right? Because like I rarely go into a project like thinking about like, I want it to have this color palette, you know?
Oh.
Usually color palettes come from the DP and or the production designer,
oh,
right?
So, like, I usually give the color palette.
Some sort of conflict around color palette being a thing that like, you know, I would be like, fuck, who cares? Let's pick the one that is the best for like everything, right? Like what works best for the characters? What works best for the storytelling in the movie? Okay, that's fine. You want mauve? You want violet? Like whatever. Like I don't give a fuck. Like let's just find the one that's the best, you know? Like I think that's sort of the thing I'm thinking about in my mind. Like I don't really know. Like maybe sets or like just deciding to shoot in a studio versus shooting, you know, in live action. But I think like, or not live, you know, out in locations or whatever. Like I think those are all things that could also be, you know, points of contention. But yeah, I mean, especially because like production designers never want things to be moved into studios because it's like, then it's like the triples, quadruples their work, you know, because they have to do so much more. Anyways, I think that's my answer. I would find a compromise. And then if there was no compromise to be had for one side or the other, then whoever is not willing to compromise goes and we replace those people, you know, which would be very tragic. But like, if you run into a person who's not willing to compromise, you probably don't want to work with them anyways. So, it might be like weeding out a bad seed. But yeah, what about you, Liz? What would you do with this one?
I mean, I just interpret this as a failure of me as the director. And that's how I was like, what am I doing wrong? I'm clearly not communicating well enough to the DP and the production designer. And so I would see this as a time for me to double down on the lookbook, the color palette, the shooting plan, whatever it is, and try to get them all on the same page. Because I would think, I don't know, I've been very lucky in that when I build my team, they are very respectful to me and they will always say like, whatever you want. And so that seems to be the solution. If two people are fighting and if I come in and I say what I want, I do feel like my teammate would say, great, I defer to you. I defer to how you choose, you know, how you want to execute this and how you want this to look on screen. I think the hard part is I'm a people pleaser. So how do you make a decision that you stand behind that doesn't just default to the easy decision? So that right. I think I'd be working on, I would figure out exactly what the conflict is, if it's, you know, camera movement or if it's location or if it's whatever it is. And I would try to audit my own thinking and figure out exactly what I wanted and then just communicate it better.
Yeah.
And also, I think you and I are very, I feel like you and I build teams of people that we really want to work with who communicate well together. Like I don't have any worries about the way we build teams. And so I feel like I would want to go forward in a way that doesn't let go of anyone, right? That you can move forward with everyone involved if possible, which seems to be your inclination as well.
Yeah, definitely. I like what you said about like not getting yourself into a situation. Like if you do your job well, like this shouldn't happen. Basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know. Good stuff. Let us know what you would do. We also have a very exciting letter from a listener, which we haven't gotten one of those in a while. So I'm going to read this. This is from Madison Young. Madison writes, "Hi, Liz and Ulrich. I'm a Bay Area writer, director, producer, and I just wanted to say how much I've truly enjoyed your podcast. Thank you for creating such an expansive and diverse group of filmmakers as guests on your show and really holding space for each filmmaker to share their process and experience in a way that is accessible and conversational. Your podcast has been a wealth of knowledge and support. In those moments when I feel like I'm losing momentum or production logistics fall through or any of the other many challenges that arise on the regular, it's in those moments that I find great strength and resilience in your podcast, stories, and perseverance. Sending all my best." Wow, Madison, thank you so much for the kind words. That's wonderful. I'm glad that the podcast has been so helpful for you.
Madison, that's so sweet of you to say. That's really cool. And we don't get, I mean, maybe Ulrich gets tons of these emails, or like in aggregate over the years, I know we've received a good number of emails, but it just always feels really lovely to know that what we're doing and what we spend time towards contributes to the indie film landscape in some positive way. So thank you very much for sending that email and for taking the time. We also have a brand new iTunes review. So this is from Lean. Yeah. Yeah. What? Were you reacting? Or were you?
Yes.
Okay.
I was reacting in the a positive reaction.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. Lean Palm, L-E-A-N-P-A-L-M, from the United States. And it's short but sweet. And it says, "You guys rock. I'm a huge fan. And I think you guys are doing a wonderful job. Keep up the good work." So Lean Palm, thank you very much for your kindness. You were the first review of 2023, and we'll never forget you, Lean Palm.
Yes, okay. Thank you, Lean Palm, and thanks for the 5 stars. That was amazing. We love you.
If any of you out there listening want to leave an iTunes review or email us, send us a question, comment, or suggestion, you could do that. Please do that. And if you want to send that email, it's podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. You could check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. We wanted to shout out Rebecca S. Grace's Feierstein Graduate School of Cinema at Brooklyn College. We want to specifically shout out the portfolio development preparing for the biz class. So, hey, y'all. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for listening, guys. Really, I think it's incredible. We're part of your curriculum, which is like bizarre and amazing at the same time.
It's so cool.
Thank you.
Also, don't forget to check out Jambox.io, which is a royalty-free music and SFX company with an emphasis on those high-quality cinematic cues. They offer customized plans, and the composers have worked on soundtracks for Hollywood-level films, including working with directors like Michael Bay and Martin Scorsese. Check them out, Jambox.io. Thank you to Saeed Crumpler for coming on the show. Big thanks to Colin, Travis, and Kristen from the Austin Film Festival for including us in the film festival, where Ulrich met Saeed. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Freimuth, for doing all the editing. Thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. And most importantly, thanks to all of you for listening. And talk to you all next week. In order to pull that off, you'll need all of your department heads on the same page. I'm sorry, that was a burp. Okay. Jeff, sorry. Please cut my burp. Okay.